religious organizations and journalism. He is currently the director of the Afro Middle East Center. He previously worked as director for the Operations for the Freedom of Expression Institute in Johannesburg, South Africa. He has also taught political studies at the University of Witwatersrand. In Johannesburg, Gina was also a member of the drafting committee of a landmark document produced during South Africa's constitution drafting period called the Declaration on Religious Rights and Responsibilities. He is also the coordinator of a progressive Johannesburg mosque, a spokesperson for South Africa's Palestine Solidarity Committee and Anti-War Coalition, and is a member of the International Coordinating Network for Palestine. He has also co-authored a book and published articles and papers in journals, magazines, newsletters, newspapers, and other publications. So let's put our hands together for Naeem Gina.
Thank you for having me here to speak today. It's quite an honor to be here and to have been in Canada for the past week. Having been in Canada for the past week, I feel somewhat obligated to say a word or two about what happened in the Ontario Parliament last week and what could possibly happen in your federal parliament soon. Two quick comments about that. Firstly, in response to them, yes, it is apartheid. And secondly, no, we black South Africans actually don't feel insulted and demeaned that we refer to Israel as an apartheid state. Now, I'm not the only one not the only South African and not the only black South African, certainly, that's saying that Israel is an apartheid state. Let me give you one or two other quotes. Our current deputy president and deputy president of the ruling African National Congress, Khalema Motlanthe, said that in his view, quote, the current situation for Palestinians in the OPT is worse than conditions were for blacks under the apartheid regime. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, I've been very deeply distressed in my visit to the Holy Land. It reminded me so much of what happened to us black people in South Africa. I have seen the humiliation of the Palestinians at checkpoints and roadblocks, suffering like us when young white police officers prevented us from moving about. President of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, Zduma Dlamini, they support Zionism, a version of apartheid based on the doctrine that Jews are superior to Arabs and therefore have a right to oppress them and occupy their country. Former president of COSATU, Willie Madisha, the horrendous dehumanization of black South Africans during the erstwhile apartheid years is a Sunday picnic compared with what I saw and what I know is happening to the Palestinian people. I can say with confidence, he says, that Israel is an apartheid state. So why do we, as South Africans, why do we refer to Israel as an apartheid state and are so convinced, as Willie is, that it is so? Firstly, let me just say our understanding of an apartheid state or understanding of apartheid is an institutionalized and systematic way in which people are discriminated against on the basis of their race or their ethnicity. A system where rights and privileges flow to people on the basis of their race or ethnicity. In South Africa, those who are privileged were whites. In the Palestinian context, those who are privileged are Jews. Apartheid in South Africa rested on three pillars, and I want to discuss that briefly before I talk about Israeli apartheid. The first pillar, the first of these three pillars, was a way in which there was a formal demarcation created between South Africans, so that they were then distinguished into different so-called racial groups. So we had, for example, the Population Registration Act, in terms of which people were classified as either white or colored or Indian or African. In South Africa, we usually put the prefix so-called in front of these, but I'll skip that for now. and then a range of other laws based on the Population Registration Act that then took advantage of that classification to deprive people or advantage people in different kinds of ways. So that was the first pillar. The second pillar was the segregation of these groups that have already been defined, the segregation of these groups into different geographic areas, and forcing them to live in those areas or be or belonging to those areas. The Bantustan policy in South Africa is a big part of the second pillar. In fact, the Bantustan policy is what we refer to as Grand Apartheid. Now, as an aside, let me say that often when I speak about these things, Zionists would say, how can you say that Israel is an apartheid state? You know, in South Africa, you had park benches for different races and toilets for different races. Apartheid is not about toilets and park benches. Apartheid is about Bantustans. It's about land theft. This is grand apartheid. Toilets and park benches are what we refer to as petty apartheid. It's really irrelevant. It's part of the humiliation, but it's really irrelevant in the bigger scheme of things. The bigger scheme of things is the creation of Bantustans. The bigger scheme of things is the way in which the land of African people, the indigenous people, was stolen systematically through various laws and various forms of repressive machinery, systematically stolen and allocated to white people, so that one group of people, black people, would be impoverished and disadvantaged and made virtual slaves of the other. The third pillar on which apartheid rested was its matrix, its repressive matrix, including a number of repressive laws and a repressive machinery that gave effect to those laws. Now, having very quickly and briefly outlined that, let me continue by saying that when we look at Israel, Israeli apartheid essentially rests on the same three pillars as with South African apartheid. A little note before I continue on that, and that is that I'm going to mention the issue of citizenship in Israel in a moment, but let me make two points. Firstly, that I'm talking about apartheid that Israel practices at two levels, and we have to understand that. Firstly, within Israel itself, which in itself is a bit of a difficult concept to talk about within Israel itself, because Israel hasn't declared its borders, so we don't really know what Israel itself is. I refuse, by the way, to use the term Israel proper. I don't think there's anything proper about Israel. Secondly, that very interestingly, for an academic anyway, not for an activist, very interestingly, Israel is probably, in my knowledge anyway, the only state in the world where there's a difference between citizenship and nationality. It's a strange thing, but in Israel, you can be a citizen of the state. So if you're part of the 20% of the Israeli population that is Palestinian, you are a citizen of the Israeli state, but you're not part of the nation. However, you can live in Canada and have lived in Canada all your life, and your parents lived in Canada, and their parents having come from Europe, and be a Jew, and you'd be regarded, you wouldn't be a citizen of Israel, but you would be regarded as part of the nation. So nationality and citizenship actually don't coincide in the Israeli context. Very strangely, because that coincidence happens everywhere else around the world. But it's done in a very deliberate way in order to perpetuate apartheid within the Israeli state. Now, let me talk firstly about apartheid within Israel itself, in terms of this first pillar. I'm still dealing with the first pillar. We have in 1950, for example, the law of return. The law of return is very critical to this first pillar, because the law of return, like the Population Registration Act, the law of return defines what a Jew is, and then grants Jews all over the world the right to come. I wouldn't say return. Because many of those Jews, of course, have absolutely zero lineage relationship to the land of Palestine. lineage relationship. And so they don't have the right to return in terms of the law, really. But they have the law grants them the right to come to Israel and be part of the nation there. The 1952 citizenship law then grants those people who have, quote unquote, returned according to the law of return, those Jews who have returned, then grants them the right to claim citizenship in Israel. There's an earlier law that's also important in terms of this whole issue of citizenship, still dealing with that first pillar, and this is the absentee property law. The absentee property law of 1948, so soon after the Israeli state was established, divides the Palestinian population that had lived in the land that became Israel later into three categories. The one category is those who are present, and these are Palestinians who were living in their homes in what then became Israel throughout the period between 1947 and 48. They were present and they have full, quote-unquote, citizenship rights in Israel. I say quote-unquote full because they actually don't have full citizenship rights. They don't have the same rights as Jews, but I'll come to that in a moment. The second category in terms of the absentee property law is those Palestinians who were absent. These would be Palestinians who, in that period between 1947 and 48, were not in their homes. And this was because they were terrorized and brutalized, chased out of their homes and their lands by the Jewish gangs, the Irgun, the Stern, the Haganah, etc., and became refugees in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, wherever the case might be. They are regarded as absent, and they have absolutely no right to return to their homes and their lands. The third category is the most interesting category. The third category is, in terms of the absentee property law, is those Palestinians who are regarded as present absentees. So these are Palestinians who were actually present in that period in what then became Israel. However, they were not in their homes, to put it crudely, so they might be internally displaced. Okay, they were forced out of their homes, took refuge in the next village or whatever the case might be. And so because they were not in their homes, they're regarded as absent, but you know the inconvenient truth is that they happen to be present. So they're present absentees. They have some citizenship rights, but not as full as Palestinians that were present. Many of these Palestinians, the present absentees, today live in what we South Africans would call squatter camps. In Israel, unrecognized villages. They live in little villages that have no services, that have no right to have services, that even if they organize their own services, like digging a well and leading water into their homes, those would be removed and destroyed, regularly have their homes destroyed, etc. They, from the Israeli perspective, they really shouldn't be here, but you know they inconveniently are. So they have to be dealt with, but you deal with them in a way that makes them know all the time that they shouldn't be here. And finally, in terms of this first pillar, in 2003, the Citizenship and Entry into Israel law bans family reunification for Palestinian families. One more point before I move off the first pillar, and that is that in South Africa, we used to have a law called the Mixed Marriages Act. In terms of the mixed, I know everyone's going to laugh when I speak about this, but in terms of the Mixed Marriages Act, it was actually proscribed for people to marry across the color line. In terms of the Immorality Act, it was also then proscribed to have sex across the color line. You could get locked up, literally, separately, that is, for that act. Israel doesn't have a similar piece of legislation, I must make it clear. What Israel is guilty of, however, is of not having any form of civil marriage. There is no civil marriage in Israel. If you want to get married, the only way you can get married is through religious marriage. So while there is no legislation similar to the Mixed Marriages Act, in effect, what happens is that a Jew in Israel cannot marry a non-Jew. The effect is similar to the Mixed Marriages Act, but admittedly, there is no Mixed Marriages Act. The second pillar then, as I spoke about the South African case, is one where people are demarcated into different areas and then limited to those areas. If we're talking about within Israel itself, in South Africa we had the Group Areas Act, one of the pillars of that second pillar, one of the main issues, main pieces of legislation of that second pillar. In terms of the Group Areas Act, people could only live in areas that were designated for their particular so-called racial group. Israel doesn't have a similar law, but numerous court judgments in Israel have made it clear that it is, if Jews in a particular living in a particular area complain, then it is not acceptable for Palestinian families to move into those areas. There are a number of court judgments that have ruled against Palestinian families that attempted to move into Jewish areas. Of course, part of the second pillar within Israel is also the piece of legislation I mentioned earlier, the absentee property law. In terms of the absentee property law, all of those people that were absent have no right to return, and so all their lands are appropriated and they're robbed of that land theft, as was the case with the second pillar in South Africa. Those who are present absentees also have lost their land. But even those who are present, I mean, I've met Palestinians who are citizens of Israel who have taken me around and shown me their grandparents' land and their parents' land, which they have no access to today. In Israel, 93% of the land is regarded as what is called national lands. That's broken down into two categories: state lands owned by the state and JNF lands owned by the Jewish National Fund. All national lands, so that's the one category, national lands. The other category are private lands. All national lands are exclusively for Jewish use. So Palestinians have access to land only in that 7% that is regarded as private lands, which of course Jews also have access to. So this is part of the whole land issue within Israel. In the occupied Palestinian territory, this second pillar is illustrated by, for example, the fact that you have settlements which are for exclusive Jewish use in the occupied territory, in the West Bank in particular, and East Jerusalem, which is of course part of the West Bank. Settlements which are for exclusive Jewish use, and so we have a complete separation between areas that are for Jews and areas that are for Palestinians. In terms of the first pillar, I didn't mention this earlier on, the first pillar in the West Bank, there's a clear distinction. Palestinians in the West Bank are not Israeli citizens. Jews in the West Bank are Israeli citizens. Clear, okay? Access to water. In the West Bank, water resources, about 85% of water resources in the West Bank are for exclusive Jewish use, for the use of Jewish settlers. 15% is for Palestinian use. And Palestinians pay at least three times, in most cases more than that, the amount for that water than what Jewish settlers pay. The theft of land in the West Bank is, I mean, I don't know if I have to even talk about that, particularly with the apartheid wall and the theft that that is resultant of that project of the apartheid wall all over the West Bank, farming lands etc. that have been stolen, and. You know, let me just make one give one example about the effect of the wall. I'm sure many people know the town of Qalqilya in the West Bank. Qalqilya, we kind of jokingly, and it's really not a joke, but jokingly refer to as a one-town Bantustan. It's a town which is entirely surrounded by the wall, completely surrounded by the wall. The only way to get into the town is through one gate. One gate in the wall that allows you in or out of the town. And that gate is open for about an hour or so in the morning and an hour or so in the evening. Qalqilya farmers, and Qalqilya, by the way, apparently has a reputation for the best fruit and vegetables, I'm told, all over the West Bank and in the better part of the Middle East. But Qalqilya farmers have to go out of that gate to their farming lands on the other side of the wall. If a farmer happens to work too hard on a particular day and comes back to the gate after it has closed in the evening, then he or she has to sleep outside and is not allowed back in. That's the effect of the wall on the lives of ordinary people on a daily basis. The settlement infrastructure and what it does in terms of the land and land division. And when I say settlement infrastructure, it's not just these huge blocks of settlements, but also all the attendant infrastructure like the road network and the bridges, etc., etc. Talking about roads, I must say, of course, that as a black South African, I mean, it just blows my mind. We never imagined in South Africa that we could have roads that were exclusively for white people. In the West Bank, you have roads that are exclusively for Jewish use. No non-Jews allowed. So the settlement infrastructure, closures in the West Bank, regular closures, checkpoints, all of these determine where and how people live, determine how people move, whether people can move, and breaks up the West Bank into fragments, which when a black South African looks at it, reminds him or her of the Bantustans in the old days in South Africa. Little fragments of land that were divided up conveniently by the apartheid state. The one big difference, of course, is that in the South African situation, you could see that on the map, but in reality, you could actually seamlessly move. You know, in half an hour, you could move like five or six times between the Bantustan, for example, Bophuthatswana, and South Africa, in and out, in and out, in and out. In the West Bank, that's, of course, not easy. You have to pass through numerous checkpoints in order to move from one point to another. The separation of Jerusalem from the West Bank is part of the second pillar of demarcating different geographic areas, etc. The third pillar of apartheid, the repressive matrix. This is something when we South Africans think about it, it's really something that we can't relate to in terms of what's happening in the occupied territory, because we never experienced, at the worst times of apartheid in South Africa, we never had tanks in our residential areas, we never had helicopter gunships flying overhead and firing missiles into our homes. We never had fighter jets flying over our residential areas and firing into our homes. That never happened. Most of us didn't even imagine that it could happen in the middle of a residential area, in the middle of a township. This is normal for Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory, in the West Bank and in Gaza. The hermetic siege of Gaza is something that we didn't have against any of the Bantustans or any of our townships in South Africa. That kind of repression is not anything we can relate to. Sure, things like torture, which the Israeli Supreme Court has accepted is legitimate, occurs both in Israel and did occur in South Africa. Extrajudicial killings, both within the country and outside in foreign territory, occurs in Israel and occurred with South Africa. Arbitrary arrest, administrative detention, these are all things that are common. But other things, like I've just mentioned, didn't happen in South Africa, and we can't really relate to them in any kind of way. Having made these comparisons between apartheid in South Africa and apartheid Israel, I should also briefly make the point that while these comparisons are useful and it's good to know how they compare, etc., in fact, I think it's perhaps more important to look at what international law says about it. And we actually have, as Noura pointed out, we have an international law instrument that talks about apartheid. The International Convention on the Suppression and for the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid actually doesn't even mention South Africa once. It's not about South Africa. It's about certain practices that are unacceptable to the international community. When we look at Article 2 of this convention, virtually every one of the clauses in Article 2, Israel fulfills. Okay? Almost all of them, except for one. And that one being the issue of the exploitation of labor. Israel, I think they've learned from South Africa, Palestinian labor has been completely marginalized from Israel. And so Israel is not dependent on Palestinian labor as apartheid South Africa was dependent on black labor. As a result, they do not fulfill the clause on the exploitation of labor of the other ethnic group. But all the other clauses are fulfilled by Israel. And so in terms of the International Convention for the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, Israel, what Israel commits within its own within the State of Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territory is defined as apartheid, its practices are apartheid, and it should be punished for committing crimes against humanity, because that's what the convention calls apartheid practices, crimes against humanity. And that's what it is committing, that's what it should be punished for. That's what the convention is about, suppression and punishment. Now, it will not be sufficient for me to say that there are all these similarities between apartheid South Africa and apartheid Israel, without also saying that perhaps there are similarities or lessons to be learned in terms of the resistance to apartheid in the two contexts. So let me talk for a few minutes quickly about the resistance in South Africa. In South Africa, we analyze the anti-apartheid resistance as having been built on four pillars. And I'm talking a lot about pillars. Sorry about that. I'm also a Muslim, so after this section, I'm going to talk about the five pillars. Resistance to apartheid was built on four pillars. The first one being the armed resistance. This was supposedly the armies of the liberation movements outside the borders of South Africa, the Mkhonto weSizwe of the African National Congress, the Azanian People's Liberation Army of the Pan-Africanist Congress, and the Azanian National Liberation Army of the Black Consciousness Movement, which would engage the South African Defense Force in an armed conflict. So the first one was the armed struggle. The second one was the underground movement within the country. The third one was the internal resistance, or what we like to think of as the South African Intifada. And the fourth was the international campaign of solidarity to isolate the apartheid state. Now, there's virtual unanimity among analysts and activists that, in fact, the first two of these pillars, the armed struggle and the underground movement, were largely symbolic. There wasn't really a large-scale war between the South African Defense Force and the armed wings of the liberation movements, and the underground movement, its acts were largely symbolic, blowing up a police station there, a post office here, etc., largely symbolic. The two pillars that actually helped to bring about the end to apartheid were the third and the fourth. The internal resistance, which included a whole range of things, many of the kinds of things we're talking about in terms of internal boycotts, strikes, creating no-go zones for the regime, so that by the end of the 1980s, we had townships in South Africa, for example, that were complete no-go zones for the police, for the defense force, for councillors appointed by the apartheid state, etc., where we created what we called at the time organs of people's power, the objective being to make the state ungovernable. That was the third pillar, internal resistance. And the fourth pillar, of course, the isolation of the apartheid, the international solidarity and isolation of the apartheid state. These were the two that we believe were what brought apartheid to its knees. So that by 1989, the state could guarantee its fiscus for 2 weeks at a time because of the international isolation. So of course, as solidarity activists talking about Palestine, the first thing we must be clear about is our duty to support the resistance of the Palestinian people in whatever forms Palestinian people decide their resistance should take. And secondly, to engage in this campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Now, as Noura pointed out, on the 9th of July 2005, close to 200 Palestinian organizations, civil society as well as political, issued that historic declaration and call, a document which has become more significant over the past 5 years than it was when it was issued, the Palestinian United Call for BDS against Israel. Four days after it was issued, the United Nations International Civil Society Conference in Support of Middle East Peace in Paris issued a declaration which said, "We recognize that our strength lies in our ability to work collectively in unified campaigns and actions. We urge international, national, and regional social movements, organizations, and coalitions to support the unified call of Palestinian civil society for a global campaign of boycotts, divestment, and sanctions to pressure Israel to end the occupation and fully comply with international law and all relevant United Nations resolutions." 4 days later, it was as if civil society across the globe had been waiting for Palestinians unequivocally to call on them in this manner. I don't think that the drafters of the call actually realized what a quick and effective response there would be to their appeal. Close to 5 years now after that call was made, BDS has become a term that has global resonance, that is used in almost equal measure by Palestinian supporters and their Zionist detractors, and is being recognized by Zionists as a danger to their racist project in Palestine. It is because BDS is effective that there is such a hysterical campaign against it by the Israeli state and by its apologists all over the world. And Noura spoke about the Wright Institute's report in that regard. BDS, we are told, is the new anti-Semitism. BDS is slanderous. BDS is anti-Jewish. And the recent detentions a few months ago of Mohammed Othman and Jamal Jumma in the West Bank show that BDS is taken so seriously by Israel that it will even use its repressive machinery to try to silence some of the prominent BDS advocates. Now we might ask, what has BDS achieved over the past 5 years? Noura has spoken about some of the American examples. I want to speak about just a few, because there are numerous successes of BDS in the past 5 years, but just a few of them. September 2009, just a few months ago, last year, the Norwegian government excluded the Israeli company Elbit from the government from tendering for the government pension fund. Elbit is involved in different ways in the building of the apartheid wall. The action of the Norwegian government was followed later by the Danish government as well. Also in September 2009, the Spanish government excluded the Israeli university in Ariel, the illegal Ariel settlement called the Ariel University Center of Samaria, from the Solar Decathlon, which was organized by the Spanish government and a university in Spain. Both of these were actions by governments. Now, as Noura said, we expect that BDS kind of works from the bottom up. And so it's BDS and its boycotts and divestment and sanctions by government, action by governments, really comes at the end of all of this pressure from below. These two instances from September last year of governments acting against the Israeli state. Just last month, on the 25th of February, the Court of Justice of the European Union ruled that products from the West Bank did not qualify for preferential customs treatment under the Israel-EU agreement. The company Veolia, which is one of the two companies that is involved in the building of a light rail connecting Jerusalem to the illegal settlements, there's been a campaign against Veolia over the past 2 years or so. Just over the past year or year and a half, Veolia has lost more than $10 billion in contracts because of its involvement in the building of the light rail. If you want to know what BDS is worth, well, in this case, more than $10 billion. Numerous examples, of course, from Canada. Just last year, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers in January 2009, the call by 300 Canadian academics and educators also in January 2009, 500 artists last week, I was told. QP Ontario's University Workers Coordinating Committee in February 2009, Outside of Canada, also in January 2009, Western Australian members of the Maritime Union of Australia voted to support BDS. February 2009, the Church of England announced it had divested from Caterpillar. February 2009, dozens of French academics issued a statement committing themselves to cease all collaboration with Israeli institutions. Also last year, the Trade Union Congress of Britain came out in support of BDS with its 6.5 million members. COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, with its 2 million members, came out in support of BDS. New Hampshire College, that has been spoken about already. And numerous others that I'm not going to go through now. As successes of BDS, just in the past year and a half, all of the examples I gave are from January 2009. Okay? So there's a lot to be excited about. There's a lot to be optimistic about. There's a lot to look forward to. Certainly there are differences between this BDS campaign and the campaign against the apartheid South African state. The South African state did not have a global civil society lobby in support of apartheid, as the Israeli state does. At university campuses around the world, lobbying with governments, etc., Israeli apologists and Zionist supporters are all over the place. That didn't happen in the South African context. We live in a world that has only one superpower, as opposed to the previous world in which we lived our apartheid, where we had two superpowers, one of which supported the liberation movement. We now live in a world with one superpower which supports the apartheid state. So things are different in many ways. And so one can't say that because BDS is moving as fast as it is for Palestine, it'll reach success quicker than in South Africa. We can't necessarily say that. Nevertheless, BDS is no longer just a good idea for us to try out. It's a global campaign and a global movement that will sound the death knell for Israel's apartheid project. Just as the global anti-apartheid movement and its campaign to isolate the apartheid South African state was the non-violent weapon that ultimately helped to bring apartheid in South Africa to its knees, so too will the BDS campaign help bring apartheid in Israel to its knees. As a South African who lived and suffered under and fought against apartheid and racist capitalism in my country, I am convinced that our joining together in this movement will prove us to be on the right side of history and on the right side of morality. Because supporting racism is immoral, excusing racism is immoral, and tolerating racism is immoral. We have only one choice: to stand on the side of justice and the suffering and oppressed people of Palestine and the world, or forever to live with the knowledge that we deliberately passed up a unique opportunity presented to us by BDS to do the right thing and to be part of history. Thank you.
Okay, so we have an announcement to make just before the question and answer period.